Okay, so we are in the midst of sort of going down into inner space, which turns out to be really important to understand outer space. And one of the ways in which those two marry together, I wanted to start out with today. Just wanted to remind you briefly of some of the stuff that we talked about the last class or two in nuclear physics. Remember that we have evidence that most of the mass and the positive charge in the atom is in a really small region, vastly smaller than the size of the atom. And in order to sort of have that happen, we have to have a short-range force that's vast, much stronger than Coulomb force, that is active inside sort of the nucleus and sort of holds things together. The minute you do that, if you put a binding force like that in Schrodinger's equation, it will give you discrete energy levels. So we think that the nucleus has energy levels that are populated by the protons and the neutrons. And you can have transitions in these energy levels, even from states where you change from a state with a certain number of protons and neutrons to a state with different numbers of protons and neutrons, emitting other types of particles. Changing with discrete changes in energy. So you have nuclear spectroscopy in the same way that you have atomic spectroscopy, and it can be used to fingerprint nuclei and things like that. Fundamentally, what determines the energy flow within a nuclear reaction, that is energetically advantageous for something to decay into something else or whatever, is really dictated largely by how much energy is really stored inside the nucleus. And just like we have in the atomic atom, different configurations of nuclei have different degrees of stability. And one can imagine that if you have a really strong but short-range nuclear force that basically doesn't see electric charge, if I have two nucleons, they'll hold each other together very tightly, whether they're positively charged or not. If I have a third, and they all sort of have a force that's longing onto the other, they'll be even stronger. And you can imagine having super glue, and if you smeared it over two marbles and you put them together, they might hold each other fairly tightly. If you put a third in, it would be even more tight, and a fourth, it would be even a much tighter bundle, because they basically are all holding each other. And then, if you get it big enough, you can add another marble, but it doesn't really strengthen the overall pile of marbles. And if these marbles, for example, were positively charged so that they wanted to push each other away, when you are putting them together and increasing the strength of the bond, you would be making a system that's more and more stable. But then as you make the ball bigger and bigger, you're not increasing the stability by adding a little glue out here. It's becoming sort of unwieldy, and the positive charge will blow it out. So you can map this sort of stability out with nuclei, and this plot sort of gives it. This is what we call the binding energy per nucleon. It's effectively how tightly each of the nucleons is held within the nucleus. And this is the atomic mass of the nucleus, so the nuclei are getting bigger and bigger as you go out this way. So Z is also increasing as you go out. And as you are increasing the size of the bundle, and you have more and more nuclear force holding all the nucleons together, you actually are holding each nucleon in more and more tightly. So you go up on this graph, until you reach a size where you have about the most stable nucleus that we know, which is an iron. And then that's the point where you start to be so large that if you add more nucleons, that the Coulomb force wants to start to move things apart, and it becomes a little bit unwieldy. So things become a little less stable and less stable and less stable as you go down this way. So we call fusion what happens if you take two small nuclei and you somehow get them to attach to each other, which is not easy to do because the nuclear force has such a short range. until you get them very, very close together, the Coulomb repulsion wants to blow them apart. And the Coulomb repulsion is 1 over r squared. So as you get closer and closer, that force that repels them is really large. So it takes a tremendous amount of energy to overcome that. But if you can manage to do that and make a larger nucleus, you'll actually go from a state where you are less stable to one where you're quite stable and release energy in the process. And this is known as nuclear fusion. And over here, if you want to gain energy, if you could take a large nucleus and break it into two smaller nuclei, you effectively move from over here to over here. And again, the smaller nuclei, the nucleons are held more tightly, and you can release energy that way. And this is known as nuclear fission. This is much easier to do in the sense if I have a small neutron gun, which some nuclei are naturally radioactive, so you can literally make such a thing if you wish. They'll act, some of them will just naturally now and then emit a neutron, which then a neutron not being positively charged can actually go into a nucleus pretty easily. And so if you have an unstable nucleus out here and you hit it with a neutron, it'll actually sometimes be enough to break it up. And so making fission happen isn't the crazy thing. So this curve turns out to be extraordinarily important to us and in our understanding of actually the large scale universe. And I want to talk mostly about why that is today. Let me just jump into it. I'd like to talk about the life cycle of stars, actually. And we sort of think of the sun as having always been there and will always be there, and stars sort of seem as if they're very constant. But in fact, the night sky is very dynamic, and stars are extremely dynamic systems. And they basically start from what we would consider to be nothing. Interstellar medium or intergalactic medium has a vacuum that's far greater than anything we can produce on Earth. That said, in the interstellar medium, you have about one atom per 20 cubic centimeters. So that's not much. But the distances are large, and gravity is a very long-range force. I mean, it's effectively infinite. It does drop off. But if I have a whole lot of atoms that, even if their density is 20 centimeters apart, over there and not so much over here, they will eventually attract each other with gravity and collapse. So this can happen. If you go out into intergalactic space and you look at what's there, and we're going to talk about how we think we know this and the fact that it's been, I mean, basically we can make observations that indicate this. It is almost all hydrogen. Hydrogen, remember, is the simplest nucleus, just a proton with an electron. There's about 9% helium, which has two neutrons, two protons, and then about 2% elements is equal to, or greater than 2. So it's a bit bothersome, right? I mean, the lightest nucleus that is in you is carbon, which has 12, and then oxygen is 16. And you have to have all sorts of heavy elements. So that whole chart is filled. I mean, you walk on heavy elements, right? Rock and iron and things like that. So this is what we start with. And mostly these actually come from the Big Bang. And the fact that they're distributed in such a way is strong, strong evidence of something called the Big Bang, which we'll talk a lot about. And then a lot of the rest comes from what happens with stars, which is where we're going today. So if you have a universe filled with mostly hydrogen, if we assume there is some form of a density perturbation, which is sort of a big assumption, actually. You have to ask yourself, how did that get there? And we'll come back to that. But let us assume that you have regions where the hydrogen is a little bit more densely packed than others. And would still, in all of these places, be a vacuum greater than, better than we could produce on Earth. Then gravity will begin to pull the gas together. And we can talk about this happening over vast distances. So even though the density initially is really small, as you begin to pull the gas together, you have a lot of matter. Okay? And what will happen as you begin to compress a gas is it actually will heat up. And it's sort of the inverse of the process that happens if you take a spray paint can and you press it. As the paint comes out, your finger gets cold because of the gas decompresses, it gets cold. It's called adiabatic decompression in that it happens so fast, heat doesn't flow, but the fact that it expands sucks up the energy around it. So it takes energy from the region around it in order to expand the gas, but you really don't have energy flowing into the system, so it just has to basically suck it out of the temperature, so it gets cold. You can reverse that process if you compress the gas. So if you are pumping up a bicycle tire and you do some pumping, so you're taking the gas and you're compressing it, if you feel the nozzle, you'll find it gets quite hot because you are literally compressing the gas but not allowing time for energy to really flow, so it increases the temperature. And that's what happens with stars. So it's not a star yet, it's really just a pile of opaque gas that as it slowly collapses, it begins to heat up. So if you could see it, you would sort of see it glowing in the infrared. And there are astronomers here who actually make their career out of studying the early stages of stars. You might not see it initially because it might be embedded in a huge dark cloud of gas that's basically opaque to light, even infrared light. But inside, it's hotter and hotter towards the center. Slowly but surely, so one of the funny things that happens is that as you heat something up, oddly enough, it turns out that light, as it pushes out, heat is a form of light, infrared light. As it interacts with material, it actually exerts an outward pressure. It's called radiation pressure. So what will happen if you had nothing like radiation pressure happening? Gravity would just basically take this huge thing of gas, started collapsing, and it would just go to nothing very quickly. So what happens, though, instead is as it begins to collapse, it heats up in the center and the heat pushes back out. And you get sort of an equilibrium between gravity pulling in and the heat pushing out. So it's still not a star. It's basically just a ball or a big cloud of gas that's getting hotter and hotter at the center. And as it gets hot in the center, eventually, the heat sort of works its way out of the cloud and gets bled off into space. As the heat gets bled off into space, there's less radiation pressure, there's less heat pressure pushing outward, and gravity continues to pull. So slowly, this gas cloud bleeds off a lot of heat. It's still quite hot in the core, but it slowly bleeds off heat and collapses more and more and more. As it does so, there's a tiny bit of rotation in the system, and as it collapses, it will rotate more and more. You'll eventually sort of get something like a flattened pancake with most of the mass at the center. You can imagine that spinning happening like an ice skater might start spinning with their arms out, and as they pull them in, they speed up. So you have sort of a similar thing with this gas going in.
Exact same physics reasons, actually.
So you're getting hotter and hotter at the center. And you basically have this continual equilibrium between the gravitational force pulling things in and the heat pressure pushing out. But the heat in the center slowly builds up, and of course the gravitational pressure gets bigger too, because you're getting mass in a smaller and smaller area as some of the heat bleeds out into the space. This is mostly just a big ball of hydrogen at this point. And what happens as it gets hotter and hotter in the center, heat can be thought of as a measure of the kinetic energy of the particles. So as you heat something up, the particles start moving faster and faster. And there's an exact relationship between basically the velocity of the particles and the temperature of the material. That's basically what you're measuring. So as the thing gets hotter and hotter, these particles are moving faster and faster and faster. And eventually, at the core of the star, they are moving so fast that they have enough energy that in spite of the Coulomb repulsion between the hydrogen nuclei, they get close enough for the strong nuclear force to start having an effect. So what will happen is eventually you get it hot enough in the core of the star that you can begin to fuse hydrogen into helium. And in the process, you release a huge amount of energy. So now you have, at the core of this big ball of gas, a process happening that releases a great deal of energy that is pushing out, and you have gravity pulling in with a lot of force, and you end up, in time, developing sort of a stable system. And this, then, is a star. Because this energy in the core is, you have this huge amount of energy at this point, and in fact, the light that's produced here takes a long time to eventually work its way out. In fact, it doesn't really make it out. It gets absorbed and re-emitted and absorbed and re-emitted, etc. A lot of the actual energy here gets fed up to the outer edges of the star by convection, just like the same sort of... if you look at a pot of water on the stove and you turn on a burner, you begin to see sort of optical curlicues going up. So the water, the hot water rises, and as it does, it changes the index of refraction in the water around it, and so it sort of looks funny too. That process is called convection, this heat, hot thing sort of rising. It's buoyancy. It's exactly the same thing that has hot air balloons rising or a piece of wood and water rising. The hot air, or the hot stellar material, is less dense than the cool stellar material, so it will rise. And the cool stuff will go down. So you have natural circulation happening inside the star, and this heat gets out to the outer parts of the star and then gets bled out into space. Very often, there's nobody out there that decides which gas cloud is going to collapse. So sometimes you have perturbations happening and will collapse gas cloud, and that gas cloud actually isn't so big. And when that happens, you may not get hot enough in the center of this gas cloud to actually initiate fusion. It turns out that you have to have a gas cloud that has about 0.8 solar masses before you're large enough to actually induce fusion. And there are lots of objects in the universe where fusion didn't quite happen. Jupiter and Saturn are examples. Jupiter is actually quite a big object, but it is too small to have started with fusion. So it's basically a failed star, if you can think of that. And there are lots of stellar systems where the equivalent of their Jupiter actually was large enough, and you have multiple stars in the same star system. So lots of fun stuff with that. So that's sort of the start of the game. When you have such a large object and it reaches this stage, you get stability between gravity pulling in and the fusion-generated heat pushing out. And the time over which you have that stability depends a lot on the mass of the star. The temperature of the core depends a lot on the mass of the star. If you have more and more mass out here, you need it hotter in the middle in order to get stability.
So it turns out, and the hotter it is in the middle, the bigger is the region where you have fusion happening, and so you actually, for larger stars, you will they will fuse the gas and they'll burn their fuel basically a lot faster. So our star is about 4.7 billion years old, and it's expected to live for about 10 billion years total. So that'll give you an estimate. It's a relatively smallish star. So here are some pretty pictures. Here's a region in space where you basically can see a big gas cloud in here, and stars are being born in the middle of that gas cloud. There are regions where you may have stars in here which are actually starting to initiate their fusion reactions and getting hot enough that they're able to excite, and you get emissions of light from parts of the gas, which is how we can see it. Otherwise, you only know it's there because you don't see stuff behind it. In time, as the stars really initiate their fusion reactions and they get much hotter, the radiation pressure coming from the main bit of the star pushes outward and will actually literally push the tenuous gas that's around it away. And so eventually you may start out in this opaque cloud, but in time you push all the opaque stuff away and you have just the star sitting there. But these gas clouds are big, and usually you'll have regions where it's collapsing that are quite large, but you'll have other regions within it that are collapsing. So you'll have stars formed in all sorts of places. So typically what you see are stars formed in a cluster. Here's an example called the Pleiades. Actually, this time of year, probably barely early in the evening, certainly earlier in the winter, when Orion is sort of, Orion is the three stars, if you know, of the Pleiades constellations. They're sort of three striking stars that in the early winter to midwinter tend to be sort of off in the east, just coming up a little bit. And at that time, if you sort of are in a fairly dark place and you look up, there'll be a fuzzy patch up here. And if you look directly at the fuzzy patch, you sort of see a star or two that you can't quite see that it's fuzzy. It turns out that if you avert your eye a little bit, you have a tiny bit more sensitivity. So when you avert your eye away from that, you'll sort of see this fuzzy patch. So if you take a telescope and a camera and you take pictures of that fuzzy patch, this is what you see. It's called the Pleiades. And you can see several of these stars by naked eye, but it's a cluster of stars that were born effectively out of a gas cloud like that. And you actually can still see some of the gas around these stars. So these are like baby, very hot, new baby stars in the Pleiades. And they are mostly hydrogen gas. And let's see what else I have here. So as the thing collapses, you'll tend to get rotation, and some of the material, because it's rotating, sort of like a pizza dough, if you were making a pizza dough, you'll tend to get a lot of mass and star in the center with sort of this opaque disk, and within that disk, you'll have regions where you begin to get things collapsing, and that's where you tend to get planets, where it's much cooler. The planets themselves are exposed. I mean, the nature of the planets is determined a lot by how close they are to the sun and their size. So the closer they are to the sun, that will determine the basic thermodynamics of how hot they are and everything. But also, if they're too small, they don't have enough mass to basically hold the light gases in. And if they're too big, they pulled in a whole bunch of it. So
you know, Jupiter was very big, and so you have this massive ball of gas. Mercury is pretty small and close to the Sun, and it's basically just this really hot rock. There's a region of where you actually have a temperature where it's possible to have liquid water. Some people call that the Goldilocks region. And it's an area where you can imagine if there is a planet in the Goldilocks region, you can imagine possibly having life as we know it. I think a lot also has to depend on the nature of the size of the planet itself. So it's not just how close it is to the star. But there's a lot in terms of trying to understand planets. There's a lot that goes into that in terms of how things evolve with the stars and stuff like that. For the star itself, it's rather interesting. You might wonder how we know anything about stars. Maybe our sun is 4.7 billion years. I mean, we've only known the mechanism that drives the energy at the core of the star since about 1940. So we have hardly had a chance to look at the sun at all. But one of the cool things about astronomy is that you have populations of the stars out there. So it's just a little bit like if you imagine that you want to study the human population right now in aging and how things change with age, you don't do that by finding 10 individuals when they're born and following them for their whole lives, because then the study will not be complete by the time that you'll die before they will. What you do is you look at a very large population, and you look at the young people and the middle-aged people and the old people, and you sort of look for patterns, and you look at how things change over large populations. And that's what the astronomers do. So their lab is all there. They can't control it, but they can look at all these various examples of different things happening, and from that sort of infer a lot of things. So if they plot, for example, the surface temperature of the star, which in fact they can measure by the color of the light coming off it, because remember it's basically black body. Remember black body radiation, the spectrum of light comes off something depends on its temperature. So if they plot the surface temperature of the star, so this is in degrees, 3,000 degrees to 20,000, 40,000 degrees, and if they plot it against the intrinsic brightness of the star, so that's some measure of how much light is being produced by the star, and you have to be a little bit careful with that because different stars are at different brightness in part because they're different distances, so you have to correct for that. So that's why it's called intrinsic brightness. But when you plot the temperature versus the basic brightness, one actually finds that it's not arbitrary distribution. You actually have very particular regions populated by all the stars if you go and you look at them all and make measurements. And it turns out that stars will populate different regions of this graph depending on where they are in terms of their size, which determines how fast the nuclear reactions are happening in the core, and their age. So when they're very young, remember, they start out mostly hydrogen. You initiate fusion reactions in the core. It's actually more complicated than just shoving some protons together to create helium. I'll show you the reactions in a moment, and we'll go through it a little bit. But when they're young, it's basically all hydrogen, and right at the core, you have these nuclear fusion reactions happening, and you're burning hydrogen into helium. And that now has enough heat to bleed out and hold the star's atmosphere, basically, or the rest of the star from collapsing in. As it gets older, the region where you are producing fusion of hydrogen and helium becomes more of a shell, and inside of that it's even hotter, and there's a lot of helium, and you actually begin to fuse helium into silicon or other things. Okay, so as it gets a bit older, you begin to get a shell structure where out here you're burning hydrogen into helium, and inside here, you're burning helium into something else because it's hotter. So you have this multi-layered thing that begins to happen in terms of what's being burned in the star. And the way, one way to think about it is at the core of the star, I'm burning all this hydrogen into helium. And once I have helium, it's not hot enough to fuse helium initially. So as I begin to really burn away all the hydrogen into helium, the core begins to actually cool down. And the rest of the star will begin to collapse in. As it begins to collapse in, you will have the hydrogen burning in the shell out here that sort of begins to hold it out. And in the inner core, it becomes finally hot enough to initiate fusion of helium. So you have that kind of game going on. As the core gets sort of more hotter and hotter. So we actually can do nuclear physics in laboratories on Earth. So we know a whole lot about how that kind of stuff works. And in the, I guess it was sort of the 40s, I would say, physicists more or less figured out the mechanism for how the fusion reactions in the sun should work. And so this would be the primary fusion process at the core of the sun. It's called the PP process. But there are different things that can happen. But one thing you'll note is you basically are starting out with hydrogen, or two protons. They go into deuterium and basically do beta decay. They kick out an electron and a neutrino. So we haven't really talked about neutrinos yet. These are particles that we will talk a good bit about. They're neutral, and they can travel through immense amounts of material without interacting. So these actually will escape the sun right away. Most of this then goes and reacts with another proton and forms helium-3, producing a gamma. That's energy right there. Most of this then will have the helium will interact with some other helium, giving you beryllium, etc. So we're not here to memorize this, but just to get some idea, it's actually a fairly complicated process. But these are things that people have done measurements in the labs. They know the probabilities of them happening. They know what the energies are. We know, for example, the energy distribution of this neutrino and that neutrino. We know how many of them should be produced given the size of the sun. So we know actually a whole lot about stellar processes in the center of the sun. There was a puzzle in the 60s and 70s, actually up until the 90s, where we built detectors. There was a detector that was built, maybe I'll describe to you, not so much today, in a mine in South Dakota that was sensitive to the neutrinos that were coming from the sun. And they were only detecting about a third of what they expected when they mapped out the process. And people were very disturbed, actually, because it either meant we didn't know how the inner core of stars worked after all, or the sun was broken, which we hope wasn't the case, or something really strange was happening to these neutrinos as they traveled from the sun to Earth. It turned out to be the latter, which we only discovered in the 1990s. It's called neutrino oscillations. That's what I do for a living, actually, is I study neutrino oscillations. So there's a story there that at some point I may tell you about. But once we figured out what's going on with neutrinos, as I say, most of the energy produced here may take thousands of years to sort of work its way out of the sun. But the neutrinos, they just come direct to us. So it takes 8 minutes to travel in the speed of light from the core of the sun to Earth. So we basically can examine things that are happening at the very core of the sun, happening 8 minutes ago by looking at the neutrinos that are coming from the sun. And we now understand that we see the right number of neutrinos, actually. So we do believe the sun is working properly, which is probably a good thing. So as you have a large star, as it gets older and older, this layering process of different fusion things sort of gets pretty crazy. So on the outer shells, you have hydrogen going into helium. You go in a little bit. You have helium going into carbon and oxygen. You go in a little bit more. Carbon's going to neon and magnesium. In a little deeper, you have oxygen going up to silicon and sulfur. And as you get toward the core of a very large star, you have silicon and sulfur fusing to iron. So basically, we're just sort of leapfrogging our way up this chain until we reach iron at the center of the star. When you get to iron at the center of the star and you begin to form iron there, you can't fuse iron into anything and generate energy. Because if you try to fuse iron into something over here, it actually takes energy away. It requires energy to do that. So you can generate energy by going from small to big all the way up to here. And when you hit that, the energy production stops. So all of a sudden, you get the iron core there, and it starts to get cool. So you have this very, stars can enter a period of vast instability, where you all of a sudden have this massive heat production holding up the horribly large mass of the star. It's multi-layered, and now all of a sudden, the core cools off. So you still have fusion processes happening out here, but you can imagine now all of a sudden the support of one of these shells has gone away. So the shell will begin to collapse because there's nothing holding it up. There's no pressure. As it collapses, it may begin to fuse things more and more. So for example, if I collapse the silicon or oxygen layers here, if they go down, it gets hotter and hotter, which means you'll get tremendous amounts of fusion going on right there. It may only be going to iron. You'll get tremendous amounts of it. So all of a sudden, you get this vast energy production in the middle. In the meanwhile, you've got the outer shells that have lost their support, and they're starting to go in. And now all of a sudden, you have massive energy production out here that starts going out, and you'll basically sort of get this big implosion effect on the star, and you'll have you can have a tremendous explosion actually when you get to certain stages of instability in the star, and those are known as supernovas. And when you have this kind of strange process happening, it doesn't matter that it takes energy away to fuse iron into other things. You have so much energy as you have the outer shell of the star going in and the inner shell rebounding, you get such a massive amount of energy produced that you can fuse things into even the much heavier elements. And that is the origin of all the heavy elements that exist beyond iron. So, quite literally, this is from a stellar explosion. Most of them. All the heavy elements come from that process. Basically, at early stages of the universe, and we'll talk about that, all we really have are hydrogen and some very small light elements. There is nothing that's heavier than that. And then you get the other heavy elements up to iron from basic stellar fusion. And then you have these massive explosions where you get the heavier elements and you take all the other stuff and you now spread it out into space by blowing off the gas of the star. And that gas then goes out and eventually it gets collapsed into another star. Now that star is very similar to the first star, except this star now has some heavy elements in it. So you can actually tell, as the universe has gotten older, the elemental distribution in the initial state of the stars has changed. You can sort of tell at what stage in the universe's evolution a star was born by the elements that make it up, how many heavy elements are in it. Because the early stage stars, of which there are many that still exist, the universe is only 13.7 billion years old. If you have a small star that's not burning its fuel all that fast, there are stars that are really part of the first generation of stars that are still there. And then we have stars that are formed out of the gas from fast-burning stars, so they're much younger, and they contain gas that has already been through, you know, some generations of stars. Here are pictures of supernovas.
Supernovas, when a star goes supernova, that is when you have this cooling down of the core, you have a collapse in, and a sort of a rebound, and you have the outer shells going in, and the whole thing basically explodes. The amount of energy that's produced is just breathtaking. I should have done my homework to come up with the correct numbers and give you some sort of scale, but it's absolutely ridiculous and large. This is what's known as the Crab Nebula. In 1054, this was observed by Chinese and Arab astronomers as all of a sudden there's this great big new bright star in the sky. And if you look at it now, the time has passed. What was the atmosphere of that star has just been blown out into space. And if you have a nice camera and telescope, you can take a picture of it. And that's what you see here. The fact that it glows is because you still have a lot of energy in here. And in fact, there is, at the core of this thing, there is the remnant of the star itself. It's also generating still a lot of energy that is exciting the gas, and that gas then emits light, and that's what we see. Here you can see evidence of multiple explosions. Basically, you have different wave fronts coming out from that star. Here's another one. So there are lots of numerous examples of those. It's a really cool thing. You don't want one very close to it. If there was one very close in our interstellar neighborhood, so much energy would be produced that could basically destroy life as we know it. And again, you can actually calculate how close a supernova of a reasonable size could be, and for us to actually survive it. It's a very violent process. So here I just wrote down in words for your notes things that I basically just said. So what's left behind, or whether a star really goes supernova or not, depends a lot on how big the star happens to be. You can imagine if the star is of a certain size, you never get the iron in the core. So you're never going to really burn all of the stuff. Sometimes stars will sort of die a more gentle death. So if they don't go supernova, or if they've blown off a lot of their atmosphere in a supernova and they're sort of what's left, well, no, this would be small stars. So for stars in the range from 0.8 to 1.4 solar masses, they generally don't explode as a supernova. What happens is that they will burn their nuclear fuel, but it never gets hot enough to initiate all the way up the iron. And they will slowly actually just cool off. And these are known as white dwarf stars. And in this case, they slowly cool, and you could say basically gravity wins. But so what happens is that you no longer have the heat production holding the star up, so the gas will continue to collapse. And as it turns out, as it collapses, you will more or less force the atoms to be about as close as they can get. And remember that you have the electrons in the outer shells of atoms are fermions, so you can't really shove other electrons into the same quantum states. So that's known as degeneracy pressure. So there's a physical process that more or less keeps you from collapsing all of the atoms into the other atoms. And that effectively creates a sort of a quantum mechanical pressure that holds the star up. And this thing will just basically cool off. And it's known as a white dwarf. If the star is a bit bigger,
say 1.4 to
2.5 solar masses, now it's large enough, it will make a supernova. And what you have in the center now is something where you have a vast amount of mass that manages to be so massive it overcomes this electron degeneracy quantum mechanical effect, effectively more or less shoving the electrons and the protons and creating a big ball of neutrons. If you were to do such a thing for something about the mass of the sun, it would be 10 kilometers in size. So the density of the matter in this beast is really, really high. So for large stars where you have big supernovas, very often what is left behind is this thing, which is known as a neutron star. So it's a very strange beast. The density is very, very high. Remember, it had rotation, so it's spinning very, very, very fast. It has large magnetic fields, which can cause the charged particles that are produced in it to be focused, actually, in particular ways. So very often, these things are spinning, and as they spin, they'll actually create beams of particles and light that go off in certain directions that can spin. And we call them pulsars in part because as they spin, you actually get a signal that is that is cyclic in time as the thing spins around. And partly why we understand the nature of these things is we have actually measured these intermittent signals. That's how they were first discovered. Here is a supernova that has happened sometime in the past. You can see the gas around it. And they were able to map a pulsar signal in space with a visible signal. And you can see where I've blown up a section here. Well, I didn't do it. Where whoever made a picture that I stole did it. And in the center, you can actually see this bright spot. And that is light coming from some beast like this, the pulsar. So this we've actually seen and understand pretty well. And it's a strange sort of thing. The stars in this mass range tend to go into that.
Now, if what is left behind after supernova is large enough, if the star is large enough, so say greater than 2.5 solar masses, then what holds a neutron star up is sort of the same thing that held up the electrons, except neutrons are fermions. So basically, I take it and I collapse it down until the thing has about the density of a nucleus, really. And then the neutrons will hold each other up because of the quantum mechanical effect, and you can't put the two fermions in the same space. If you have enough mass, the gravitational pull is enough to overcome even that. And when that happens, there's nothing that can stop it. So what will happen is then all that mass continues to collapse. As it does, the gravitational field becomes greater and greater, and eventually that gravitational field is so great that even light cannot escape. Or remember, we were talking about how light goes in a straight line, and you think of gravitation as being the curvature of space and time. Imagine if the gravity is so strong that it has curved the space around it such that when you shoot a beam of light, it just goes in a circle. And that's what we call a black hole. And these are certainly very strange beasts. So if you recall, we discovered, since space and time are tightly entwined, in this picture, if you think of gravity as bending space and time, gravity also affects the relative speed of clocks. So if we were to take a clock that somehow was a super clock so that it didn't get destroyed by the gravitational field as you threw it into a black hole, as we watched it go into the black hole, we would see that clock slow down and slow down and slow down. And when it reached this point where light can no longer escape, it would basically just stop. And from our point of view, we would see it stuck there forever. But remember, relativity is this weird thing. It all depends on the point of view. So if you were able to ride that clock, you wouldn't notice such a thing.
you would just go right into the black hole, whatever it is. So very strange business. And if you start to ask questions like, well, what goes on inside the black hole? Well, that's a very odd business because, remember, we are now causally disconnected from it. So in fact, there is one multiverse that is called the fecund multiverse, F-E-C-U-N-D, which you'll read about, and I'll talk a bit more about. But it's a speculation as to what happens inside the black hole. We're now causally disconnected from it. So in fact, a guy named Lee Smolin, who actually is working at a place called Perimeter Institute, not far from Toronto, he has an interesting theory where inside the black hole, the space-time continues to collapse and then rebounds, and when it does, he gives it the characteristics of a Big Bang. And so he effectively has universes being born within the centers of the black hole. So it's a very interesting sort of cosmology. We'll talk about that one. It has some fun characteristics. But okay, so this picture is not a real picture. So how do we know black holes exist? As many star systems are not single stars. They're multiple stars. So imagine that you have a star here and this other star basically forms a black hole. It's going to suck gas into it. And so the gas will spiral down and slowly go in. As you have normal matter getting close to a black hole, if the gravitational field is strong enough, you can imagine it's pulling like this on the matter. And even across a proton, that's enough to sort of rip it apart. So when you rip apart gas from basically spiraling into such a strong gravitational field, it gives off characteristic X-rays. And those have been observed. So we actually do have evidence that black holes exist, although, you know, saying you've seen one is sort of hard to do. So that's the life cycle of stars. Any thoughts, questions? I've been talking a lot. This course, some parts of this course are really good for discussion, and some parts are just me talking. So I have to figure out how to make the talk add everything more conversant on the problem of physics in general. Any questions? Yeah.
Since there's no cloud around the neutron star, is it still giving out black muddy heat?
Yeah, it is up to a point. I mean, it will eventually cool down where it's not really.
But then, like, I'm sorry, please.
I mean, we've seen it. Yeah, that one picture is actually optical light. So what happens? I'm no expert on neutron stars, but you have this thing spinning tremendously fast. I mean, we have things like millisecond pulsars. So basically, you have something that has the mass that might be bigger than our sun collapse into something about 10 kilometers in size and spinning hundreds of times per second. And you have dynamic processes in this thing that will create really strong magnetic fields, and you have a lot of energy going on, so lots of charged particles and light can be produced. Well, lots of charged particles. When you take charged particles and you send them into a magnetic field, they basically move in circles. So it turns out that when you have a really strong magnetic field, it will focus the charged particles along the magnetic field lines. And so you sort of get these beams of charged particles. They're spinning, and as they spin, they'll also emit light. So you will get mechanisms where you will have sort of along the magnetic field poles of these beasts, which may not necessarily be the rotational poles, you'll get really bright light emitted. And so that's why we end up with these sort of lighthouse-like effects with pulsars, and so that's how they got discovered, because we saw this millisecond blast of energy coming from this thing that seemed to be very regular. And that one picture I showed you is a picture where we're actually able to map the radio signal onto an optical signal. So I'm not I haven't studied neutron stars enough to know where all this energy is really coming from. I mean, I don't think it's all cut and dry. We'll still have some fusion stuff happening around it, probably, because there's some energy there. But presumably, you do get it to sort of settle down. It's got a tremendous amount of energy in its rotation. And one of the ways in which we know one of the big tests for general relativity turned out to be the way in which a pulsar slows down. And it kicks energy out via the processes I just mentioned. It also turns out that it emits gravity waves. And we don't see the gravity waves, but we can see their effect on the spinning rate of the pulsar. And it's actually one of the Nobel Prize. It's one of the ways in which we believe that general relativity is correct. Yeah?
It talks about fermions and the process of star formation.
If I take two fermions, I can't put them in the same quantum state. So if you have, for example, a big ball of neutrons and gravity is pulling in, eventually you get to the point where the gravity is basically trying to put them into the same space. And you really can't. They don't want you to do that. So there's this thing called the degeneracy pressure, which is effectively a quantum mechanical reluctance, which effectively to allow you to put the particles in the same space. And that we call degeneracy pressure because it takes the form of pressure pushing out, if you want to think of it that way. It is finite in size, so if you have enough mass, we can break it and collapse into a black hole. Okay, so stars are important because we can observe them. Nuclear physics is important in part, gives us a lot of clues because we can observe the abundance of different materials in the universe. So, as we start to talk about cosmology and how we know that the Big Bang happened, part of how we know is the distribution of the abundance of various elements. And stars are a big part of that mix because they change that abundance as they burn and they go through their evolution.
But it is one of the great clues. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is sort of to continue in. We have talked about atoms, we've talked about nuclei, and the next thing I want to do is to look within nuclei at higher energies and try to see what we can learn from that. There are lots of places where you can get more information. Here are a few links. I'll post this. So again, you know, we've already realized that we've got all this positive charge in a small region. Something has to hold it together. So then you might ask, well, how do we know anything about what's going on in the nucleus? And there's an analogy that I like to use, which is imagine that you were some caveman who somebody is able to create a warp in time and have you show up here today. And you're sitting there and you see these cars go by, right? And you're wondering how they work, but you don't know how to open the hood. Okay, so you could imagine doing an experiment. And in this experiment, you find a bunch of your friends and you give them too much to drink and you let them drive the cars around and crash them into one another. And you look at the stuff that comes out, okay? And if you did this with enough cars, you would begin to be able to find patterns
and try to infer things about how cars work. So you would begin to notice that all of the cars have things which we call spark plugs. But you would notice only some cars have Mercedes-Benz symbols and others have different symbols. So you could sort of eventually figure out, if you did enough of this, what are the core pieces that really are essential for cars to function. And in time, you might even be able to figure out how a lot of it fits together.
But you basically do it by ripping it apart. So we do that to look inside the nucleus and even further into smaller and smaller particles, not by bashing the cars together, but by bashing the particles together. And here's an example. This is Fermilab, which is in Batavia, Illinois, about an hour out of O'Hare. And from the air, you can see the footprint of sort of the accelerators. And so this is one of the accelerators that we use. In order to see the particles, we have to surround the region where they collide with large detectors. So as we produce all these various particles, some of which are charged, some of which are not, as they stream into our detector, we can detect them with various things. Now, they're tremendous energies. So we're talking about energy scales on a per collision that are vastly larger than what you have in the center of a star or in a nuclear reaction. Chemical reactions happen on a scale of about 10 electron volts to 100 electron volts. And if I have a kilogram of that, then I have an explosion. For nuclear material, remember, the changes in the structures of the nucleons and nuclei undergo changes of millions of electron volts, which is why if I have a kilogram of that and set it off, I have a nuclear explosion instead of a chemical explosion. At the LHC, it's about 7 million times bigger than that on a per collision basis. We don't vaporize all of France because we're not doing it with a kilogram. We're doing it with just individual particles. So you never notice individual particles in the chemical processes. You never notice it in their nuclear processes. You do have nuclear decays happening in you all the time around you, but you don't really notice it because there's only... The way to think about it is there's well over 10 to the 23 atoms in a few grams of material. So that's a lot. But that said, you do have a lot of energy produced into the particles that are produced, and they go streaming out. And we have multi-layer detectors that allow us to analyze the direction of the particles, their charges, and their energies. And from the characteristics of the different particles coming out, we can actually identify whether they're photons or other types of particles. Let's see this. Here's an example of a very large-scale detector, and this is the computer image of the signals that came from one of the collisions in the center of the detector. This detector is set up so that there's a large magnetic field that's going sort of from where your eyes are into the board. And charged particles produced in the center moving in a magnetic field of that nature will go in curves like you see here. If they have a positive charge, they'll go one way. If they have a negative charge, they'll go the other way. So that's how you know what their charge is. This device that's black here, and so you're not really seeing the data, actually is a way of collecting electronic signals along the path of charged particles. So you can figure out the direction of the charged particle as well as its charge, and you can more or less get a measure of its velocity as well. As the particles move through, you enter a region of the detector here, which actually consists of lead plates and liquid argon. As the particle goes in, it will react, it will hit the material and basically destroy itself and shower into a bunch of other particles. And you can actually get a measure of the energy of the particles that way. And these
kinds of pixels are actually measures of energy that have been observed in that part of the detector. So just like an auto crash, like an insurance guy or a cop might reconstruct what happened in an auto crash, if you had a really fast truck going this way and a little car going that way, when you look at what's left after the crash, is most of it will be over here because you have the big truck coming this way and the car there. You can look at the lengths of skids, you can look at the distribution of the mass, and you can actually reconstruct what happened in the collision. And we really do pretty much the same thing here. We can look at what comes out and reconstruct what happened in the center of it. It's sort of a big scale business. There's a couple of videos coming out of CERN. Oops. So that's near Geneva. You put it well underground because all these particles rotating about hitting each other produces a lot of other particles or radiation, so it's dangerous. And then, as I said, the detector itself has to be multi-layered in terms of this stuff that you're detecting particles with. And as you go to higher energies, it's a very big scale. So it's a huge, huge device. The accelerator itself is about 27 kilometers in circumference. We were building one south of Dallas in the early 90s that was about 100 kilometers in circumference that Congress canceled eventually. So you get these counter-rotating beams of particles and you basically try to bash them into each other. You don't succeed all that often, but when you do, it can be fairly spectacular in the subatomic world. And then you have this multi-layered detector that you use to try to reconstruct what's going on. So, one way to think of it is you start out with this nucleus and you try to understand what's happening with the nucleus by shooting it with other particles and looking at how they scatter and what kind of crap comes out and what its distribution is. So that's a way to think about it. But it's much deeper than that because it's not just a matter of trying to identify different types of particles. You all of a sudden have to ask, well, how do they actually interact? And what do we really mean when we talk about a force? And what forces exist in nature? So it's not just what is the structure of matter, but it is what is the nature of a force. And then it gets much deeper than that because as I go up in energy, remember the de Broglie wavelength is getting smaller and smaller. So that means the particle becomes more and more point-like. So literally I'm sensitive to smaller and smaller processes. In addition, I'm going up in temperature. So forces that happen at low temperatures may be different from how they happen at high temperatures. And worse than that, I could imagine having a spectrum of particles, some at very low mass and some at very high mass. When I'm in a cool universe like I am now, the particles at low mass will be what I create, what I see, the stable ones that I see there. If you imagine being in a regime where I have a tremendous amount of energy, I have enough energy that every time the particles hit one another, they create other particles, that there's enough energy to make large mass particles. So that may mean, for example, that they're in a very hot universe, very massive particles are very common. And it turns out that that may affect the forces themselves. So if you imagine for a moment that we live in this crazy universe that is expanding and you go backward in time and it was very, very, very hot, then the forces and the particles that existed in the early universe are really rather different from what we see today. And if you want to understand cosmology and how the universe has evolved, you quite literally need to understand the types of particles and the processes that existed early on, and how, and the phase transitions that they went through as the universe cooled and expanded. So as we look at subatomic particles at the highest of energies, we are literally going back in time and looking at processes that happened in the early universe.
So it gets all tied together, which is why I'm dragging you through it right now. So any questions? I have to stop here for the day. And we'll continue with particle physics Wednesday.
What happened to the research for the Texas Collider?